Thanks, Elijah, and to all of you brothers who've led us in our services this morning. And welcome to all of you. It's so good to see each of you and your families today. And thank you to some of you for being our guests this morning. Hope you'll come back every time you can. You know, the three stories in Matthew chapter 25 are often read as stories of judgment. The setting leads to that, the messages lead to that, and what each of them says has some kind of implication in that way. These are stories that right before them, Jesus is standing in Jerusalem telling his disciples that that great temple and all the stones there are not going to last. They won't stand one on another. And then in the beginning of chapter 26, the first thing he says is, It's time in for the Son of Man to be taken and abused and executed and then to be raised up again. And in between that, these are stories of, in some way, some responsible one, whether a bridegroom or the owner of property or the great shepherd who has the right to do so, exercises the determining authority that he has on what has gone on in other people's actions. So they are stories of judgment in important ways. The five wise, the five foolish young women, the parable of the talents, and then the story of the sheep and the goats. But what we shouldn't overlook here is that these are also, upon a little reflection, all three stories of serving. Very much in the background of all of this is what Jesus has said about not knowing the time when all of these things are going to happen and therefore needing always to be watchful and ready. And he points out that the servant who is most blessed of all is the one whom the Lord comes and finds, his master comes and finds him doing his job or being responsible or being faithful to his task. And the great reward to that kind of a servant is just the privilege of serving more. What we mean by serving is engaging in activity that the Lord wants us to do and which would cause us to take even greater delight in being able to do more in that way for Him and as He would trust us to do. Over these 3 weeks, as Justin said, we want to examine the stories from that perspective. What do they tell us about serving? What do they say to the church, to the Lord's people, about serving? It's my privilege this morning to try to give a little glimpse of the first one, the one that we call the parable or the story of the maidens, the ten maidens that Jesus describes, whose actions Jesus describes for us in the first 13 verses of the chapter. This story about the wise and foolish approaches to serving and the way that leads to outcomes that are either such a blessing or such a disappointment lead us to think about what we're trying to do for the Lord in our lives. I think in the first part of our study this morning, in this case, it'll be useful for me to try to remind us a little bit about how their customs and practices about marriage or a wedding are different from the ones that we're most usually familiar with. And then we'll read the passage after that. I should point out that the process of engagement and marriage among the Jews, Jesus' fellows at that time had three steps to it, which is a couple more than usually we think of when we consider the process of getting married. First, there was the promise of marriage that was usually formalized by a formal agreement of all things between the parents of the prospective bride and groom. It was an agreement between the two sets of parents that was often sealed by a payment like a dowry from the bridegroom's father to the father of the bride. And that promise of marriage was an important element in their cultural setting and in their community life. It was something that people knew about and respected. The second step was more akin to what we would call the actual engagement between the couple, but it was more formal, much. It was called the betrothal. It began with a public exchange of vows and gifts between the couple, and they were at that point legally committed to marry one another. Any ceremony or promise that took place happened at that point. They didn't begin to live together at this stage, not until stage three, but they were legally considered to be married. It was a betrothal. That's different, isn't it? And then as much as a year later, the third step in the process would occur. It was the great wedding feast, the most pride and joy-filled occasion of their social life or of their family life at the time. It marked the completion of the betrothal time. It would be a large celebration. It would include everybody in the community who either recognized it or participated in it. You could be a guest and allowed to come. You could still and were expected to, as a community member and a friend, join in recognizing the celebration in some way. It could last several days, and then only after that great wedding feast or banquet did the couple begin to live together as husband and wife and to develop their own home in that way. What we're going to read about in Matthew 25 happened on the first day of that great wedding feast. That's a way to understand, kind of keep your place in what's going on here. Now, on that day, they also had their own very much honored and enjoyed customs and traditions that went into the process. The wedding feast involved the bridegroom, who would be surrounded by his friends, who would then go generally after sunset, and is in our story here sometimes late at night, to the house of the bride, his promised and betrothed wife, to fetch her home, to live in his home, in their home, as husband and wife. He wouldn't just get everything all set up and then text her and say, "Honey, I've got everything straightened up. Come on over now." Not that kind of thing at all. He would go with his friends to bring her back, and it was full of joy and expectation and meaning in their life. The bride, who would be dressed, of course, in her very best, would be carried by his friends in a what would we call it? A stretcher doesn't seem right for a wedding, but a litter, that type of thing, they would carry her then to the bridegroom's house, but an important part of the process was the procession. The procession that would be formed by the bride and her bridegroom's friends. Some of them would have been invited. It would have been a great honor. But along with this went the community. The light for the procession was provided by lamps on poles. Sometimes people understand this as if they were a particular kind of torch that was used only for this occasion and was handed down within a family by their tradition for that meaning and that purpose. And it would involve materials on the end of it, soaked in oil, which would shine brightly, And then along the way, when the bridegroom's home was reached through all of that parade of light, then the wedding supper was eaten and the celebration and the joy started. Now that leads us with the question of who the 10 young women are in the story I'm about to read for us. It's going to be obvious that when the door shut after everybody went into the wedding feast, that was important. So to understand it, you ask who these 10 young women are. The word is formally translated virgins, which means unmarried young women in this case. Sometimes it's translated bridesmaids in a lot of the newer versions. I've just put it maidens here. And here's why. One of the commentators I enjoy reading, last name of Tasker, says it's most probable that in this case, the bringing home of the bride, in this procession, the 10 girls in the story are pictured out as going to meet the bride and the groom together, whether as official bridesmaids or servants of the bridegroom, or children or friends and neighbors, we have no means of knowing. But then think of this. Official bridesmaids seem to be ruled out by the fact that of what the parents provided for the wedding celebrations. So they're more likely either servants of the bride or children of friends and neighbors in their community. And here's the crucial thing. They are persons who have received no invitation, but who will be welcomed in to the wedding if they form a part of the procession, the more so if they honor the bridal pair with lights. All right, now, try to summarize a lot of their customs to get down to that last point. Now, with that in mind, here's what the Lord said, Matthew 25, verses 1 through 13. Then the kingdom of heaven, then is when he comes, then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish, and five were wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight there was a cry, "Here's the bridegroom! Come out to meet him!" Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out." But the wise answering, "Since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves." And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came, and those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. And afterward, the other virgins came also saying, "Lord, Lord, open to us." But he answered, "Truly I say to you, I do not know you. Watch therefore," Jesus said, "for you know neither the day nor the hour." That's kind of an intimidating story in some ways, isn't it? I'd like to pursue it with a little thought here about what this might reveal to us about how serving is thought of among the Lord's people. What might this little story help us to understand about our own place and expecting the wedding feast to begin and doing our part to make it the main thing, being there the main thing in our lives and being ready and sure that we don't miss out on it when the time comes. It is important, first off, to think of it as as all the service that goes on among the Lord's people is actually preparing. I'm going to use five P words here this morning to just be able to understand. It's preparing. It's getting ready. In a way, it's simply practicing for what we think is going to happen later on. Jesus is telling us in the parable I've just read that a wedding feast is coming, or a party is coming, a wonderful time of joy and celebration that's in other places called the banquet of the kingdom or the wedding feast of the Lamb. And those who live their lives now regarding this truth as most significant are going to do a better job of living. That's very much the line of thought that the Lord is teaching us here. So you notice in this place, everybody knows a wedding feast is going to happen. The bridegroom is going to come. All 10 of the young women in our story are going to have opportunity, even if it's just by virtue of their being members of the community or friends of the bride and the bridegroom's families, to be there, to enjoy it, to be a part of the procession, to take in being a guest at the wedding feast and engaging in the great joy that all surrounded that. But their task is just preparing. They're not earning the right. They're not buying their ticket. They're not producing their place. They're simply wanting to enjoy the privilege, or having the privilege, to be included among the ones who love that bride and that bridegroom. Therefore, getting the oil, being out there to meet him, accompanying him to the wedding feast, that becomes important in all that. They're just simply preparing. Serving is getting ready. Serving is practicing for the reality that we want to be ours. Serving is acting now in keeping with who we are in relation to that great banquet. I read a story of a prisoner who was held captive in the concentration camps of Germany during the time of World War II. This was a fella who had huge talent. He had taught music at a university and was a very talented piano player. Every day in that terrible camp, he would practice playing his piano, even though he had no piano. And the way he did it was to go to the wooden slats on his old bunk and then to finger those slats as if they were keys of his instrument and play in his mind the great melodies that were so familiar and beloved to him. His fellow prisoners could not understand. How can you be doing this? They asked him why he did it. And he answered, "Every day I practice for the time when my freedom will come." Now that's how the Lord's people see serving. We're practicing. Remember last week from Titus chapter 2, it talked about all those who are taught by grace, who have loved His appearing, Titus 2 verse 13 and 14. What happens then is that people who love His appearing start being zealous for good works, start wanting to do good things, start wanting to help, start wanting to be a part of the Lord's service. So serving among the Lord's people is preparing. Serving among the Lord's people is practical. In this passage, if you have a torch or even a lamp with a little wick stuck in it, energy is going to be required in order to produce any light. And for it to keep on producing light, it will have to have energy that keeps on supplying it with what it needs. So no one would want to carry a flashlight on a long journey with no battery in it. If you were going on a two-week vacation and wanted to talk to your friends, you would make some kind of provision for charging your phone, right? So in this passage, you can understand that having prepared to be ready when the bridegroom came, and having thought about how you would supply light for the procession, and then having thought about how you would keep that light shining brightly, namely with some oil in this case, all of that would have been practical, purely practical, necessary type thinking. What you may not see as easily is that when the five wise girls who had brought oil with them were ready when the bridegroom came late at night, when they said, "There's not enough oil for us and yourselves," they were not simply being selfish or mean. They were thinking about the bridegroom and bride's wedding feast, the procession along the way. If they did not have a light, enough oil at least to keep their lights going, it was going to be a very dark and discouraging type of celebration. So it was practical for them to say, "I'm sorry, you're going to have to buy your own in this case." The reason is, there's not enough. They had to think about enough. Serving involves the kind of thing that you know, the kind of things that you notice when you're paying attention. The kinds of things that you take into account because you care. The kind of things that you realize because somebody has to do it. That's serving. It's realistic. It's practical. And it was in this case here, the most practical thing there ever has been are people who want to be ready for the Lord's appearing. They're not otherworldly. It's not thoughtlessness. It's truly practical in its impact. Third, serving among the Lord's people is personal. The kind of preparing that's practical we're talking about is personal, because there are some things that other people can't do for you, no matter how much they want to. Nobody can attend to my character but me. You can't do it for me. Nobody can build my relationship to God but me. You can't do that for me. You can't hire staff to do that for me. Nobody can engage in the good works that you in particular have the opportunity and the ability to do in your life every day. There are some things that other people can't do for us. Not even God can do for us. In this passage here, you can see that each of these 10 wanted to be included in the wedding feast, which meant that each of these 10 needed to have prepared for it and gotten ready for it and been present to go in whenever the door was opened. It was a personal thing. One commentator said, "Spiritual preparedness is not something which can be distributed round in a crisis." You think about that. It's right, isn't it? It's not something that whenever you think of only when the crisis comes, and then you have to deal with it. So it's very personal in that way. Fourth, serving is present. It's not when I was back then, boy, what we did back then, how it was in the good old days. And it's not, man, when I get this and this and this and this, this done, when I get past this milestone, then I'm really going to get with it. I'll be on fire then. Serving is what about right now? These I don't know where these girls all were when they were waiting for the bridegroom to come. I know it was long enough that they grew drowsy and slept. All of them are not to blame for that. I know it was about midnight. I know it was suddenly there was a cry. The bridegroom comes. So what they had been thinking about when they went out there, it was present. It was time. Justin showed me a clip from the movie American Underdog, which is Kurt Warner's story. Kurt Warner was the quarterback who won a Super Bowl for the St. Louis Rams when there were St. Louis Rams. The thing is, Kurt Warner, and by the way, he passed for about, I don't know, 6 miles in pro football. He's in the Hall of Fame. But Kurt Warner, in between college and that year when he played for the Rams, sacked groceries in a grocery store. Wasn't a quarterback at the same time either. Kurt Warner was a fine college quarterback at Northern Iowa. He was drafted by the Green Bay Packers at the time when Brett Favre was the Packers quarterback. The scene in the movie Justin showed me shows his first day when he showed up for Green Bay's practice and workouts and off-season. Favre's running the team on the field out in the background. And there where Warner is, there's a line of other would-be QBs who are throwing passes on the sideline, warming up, and Warner's standing there with them with a red jersey. I'm not sure if that means he's a rookie or whatever, but all of a sudden the coach walks off the field toward him and says, "Get in." And Warner looks shocked and he answers, but I hadn't been here long. I don't know the playbook yet." Coach says, "You don't want to play?" "Yeah, but I just don't know the playbook yet." So the coach just sends somebody else. The next day, it shows the next scene. Warner walks in, knocks the door, walks in the coach's office. The coach says, "We wish you well." Warner is stunned. And he exclaims, "You're letting me go? You can't do this. I've been preparing for this my whole life." And the coach answers, "If you had, you'd have been ready." Man, that makes it awfully present, doesn't it? I'm glad the story in Warner's life did not end there, but it could have if he hadn't have taken action that followed up on that stunning reality, which leads to the other thing. Among the Lord's people, serving is not only preparing and practical and personal and present, but it's priority. It's a situation where, to people who really get it, the main thing is being included in that marriage feast, enjoying the party, going in before the door is shut. That's what we watch for and what we long for and what we want more than anything else. That's what matters to us. You know, I don't know why the bridegroom didn't get there till midnight. But I can see that when he got there, he wasn't willing to wait to delay the start of the celebration of his bride and of their wedding feast. So he expected people to care enough about him and his bride and this occasion in their life to be ready, apparently, at the moment, to have that as their priority, to lighting the way along their processional route. I read something that David Lankford wrote in a little magazine Mark sent me. He talked about having had to learn how to drive in Houston. That's Debbie's hometown. He said, in Houston traffic, if you wait until you see the signs for your exit off the freeway, you'll miss it. Now, you young people don't holler, but you have your phone, you have your maps. Well, not all of us do. I have my ways and K's. That's how I find myself getting around. If you wait until you see the signs for your exit off the freeway, you'll miss it. And then he said, you have to know where you're going so you can be careful to be in position and ready to exit even before the signs appear. You know what I learned a couple weeks ago? At some times of the day, you have to do that between here and Ozark on Highway 65. You have to know where you're headed, and you have to be in the right right position before the sign appears. Therefore, a lot of people who are worrying about signs of the Lord's coming are missing the point. The point is that the priority in our lives? There are some truths about serving here that are important, that will help us in our personal lives, in our congregational lives, and in the Lord's kingdom. I encourage us to think about those things all the way along. Someone wrote, opportunity may knock more than once, but at some point it knocks for the last time. Right now, it's knocking. The Lord says, whoever will, let him come. Come to me. I'll give him rest. My yoke is easy and my burden is light, like we sang a while ago. There's a lot of joy to be found in serving the Lord together with his people. The beginning is belonging to the Lord. This morning, if you are thinking of taking that step in your life, make the good confession. Be joined with the Lord in baptism. Let him raise you up and walk with you each day. If we can help you, let us know by coming while we sing.